Crazy Bones said, adding that they hadn't spoken with Easy for weeks. Our whole thing at that point was, like, where's Easy at? Meanwhile, a Nation of Islam detail arrived at the hospital and began a 24-hour security watch. They were there to keep everybody from rushing in on him, said Shahid Muhammad, a Nation of Islam captain who was part of the security detail, adding that they came at the behest of Mike Klein, Ruthless's director of business affairs. It was Mike Klein who got them the detail and paid them, he said, adding that later, Ron Sweeney began making the payments. This wasn't particularly strange. The Nation has a history of guarding black celebrities, including Michael Jackson, Jesse Jackson, Tupac Shakur, Ice Cube, and Johnny Cochran. Easy's detail included up to 4 security-focused Fruit of Islam members at a time. Cedars-Sinai spokeswoman Paula Correa told the Los Angeles Times, adding that it wasn't unusual for famous patients to hire private security. Heller claimed the guards blocked him from seeing Easy in the hospital. The baby mamas couldn't get up to see him. The babies couldn't get up to see him. We couldn't get up to see him, said Gary Ballin. Tracy Jernigan said Tamika Woods instructed the Nation to keep out practically everyone, including Easy's children and his children's mothers. Shahid Muhammad, who was part of the detail, said that keeping the mothers and children away from Easy was indeed part of the detail's stated objective. Though, remember, Muhammad said he was initially hired by Klein rather than Woods. Meanwhile, rapper Stefan arrived to the Woodland Hills home where he was living, Easy's house, only to find himself barred from entering. A phalanx of Nation guards were standing in front of the door. He said his belongings were put onto a moving truck, and he was told they were taken to storage, though he was never able to retrieve them. Vince Caruso, the Ruthless College radio promoter also living in the house, seconds Stefan's account, but adds that he had better luck permeating the security. He recruited Toker to come with him, and upon sizing up the South Central gangbanger, they parted like the Red Sea and let me in to retrieve all of my things, Caruso said. But the Nation of Islam wasn't just interested in protecting Easy and his belongings. They were interested in curing him. Rumors began circulating that the Black Nationalist group had a remedy for AIDS. I heard they were saying they had the cure, Stefan said. In 1990, an experimental AIDS drug called Kemron came to market in Kenya. The Kenya Medical Research Institute reported that Kemron helped most patients gain weight and alleviated their symptoms. The drug was unveiled with fanfare and nationalistic triumph, reported the New York Times on October 3, 1990, with patients coming from as far away as the U.S. for treatment. Other researchers urged caution about the tablet, which was also known as a low-dose alpha interferon, a natural chemical that's produced in response to infection. A World Health Organization study in Uganda in 1992 and 1993 concluded the drug to be no more effective than a placebo. Nonetheless, some continued to believe its merits, and a Washington clinic run by the alternative medicine-focused Abundant Life Foundation received a $213,000 federal contract to treat AIDS patients. The foundation's director, Dr. Abdul Aleem Muhammad, was a Nation of Islam member and former Louis Farrakhan spokesman. He didn't claim that low-dose alpha interferon cured AIDS, only that studies he contributed to showed it resulted in weight gain, increased appetite, and energy levels. Still, this hadn't stopped the Nation of Islam newspaper, The Final Call, from calling it a cure for AIDS. Dr. Abdul Aleem Muhammad personally procured Kemron for Easy, Shahid Muhammad said. Dr. Aleem shipped it from D.C. on a plane, having made sure it was fresh and potent, so it would go right into his system, Shahid said, adding that he helped administer it to the rapper and it seemed for a time to make him feel better. Ceremony. Easy and Tamika Woods decided to marry. They wed on March 14th, the day before his scheduled surgery to drain fluid from his lungs.
We got married at the hospital because he wasn't sure if he was going to make it through,
Wood said. In the presence of a pastor, the short ceremony took place that evening, well past dark, with Easy in the bed, but fully conscious. The proceedings were held before a small group that included Easy's sister, brother, and parents. Almost immediately, Easy's will was written to make Woods and Sweeney co-executors of Easy's estate. The surgery, planned for the next day, was canceled, as Easy's health was deemed too fragile. As for the Kimron, the cure for AIDS, according to Shahid Muhammad, it had temporarily perked Easy up. His vitals picked up again, and he really got better, he said, though he added that before long, his pain returned.
We were all so hopeful,
Tracy Jernigan said. But though many close to Easy were in favor of him continuing the alternative medicine, Woods was against it. She didn't know what they were giving him, she reasoned. Perhaps it could kill him. Shahid Muhammad said she called it a miracle potion that wasn't going to work, and that she and Ron Sweeney promptly removed him from the security detail. He was also told to cease administering the Kimron. Woods' opposition to an unproven drug can hardly be faulted, but to Easy's desperate supporters, it seemed like throwing in the towel. That's when everybody starts saying, they got the cure, and she won't even let them give him the cure, Stefan said. When I started asking Tamika questions, she started saying, there's nothing else that can be done, said Henry. She'd given up. The morning after Easy was married, he was taken to the intensive care unit.
He always said he was going to marry Tamika,
Easy's sister Patricia Wright told me. We met at a party held on September 7th, 2014, to commemorate what would have been Easy's 50th birthday. Wright wore short, dyed green hair, a lip ring, and smart-looking glasses. Her voice sounds uncannily like Eric's. Some dispute Patricia's claim that Easy had long intended to wed Woods, or anyone for that matter. Eric was not a person to get married to anybody. He was not one to marry Tamika, said Big A. Mike Klein also maintained that Easy had expressed no interest in getting hitched, and in a lawsuit he soon filed, he claimed Easy signed his will while in a debilitated state and under medication. Sweeney and Woods denied the claims. Even if he did say he was going to marry her, Tracy Jernigan argued that didn't mean much. He told Tracy the same thing, she said. For his part, Jerry Heller called Jernigan and her daughter with Easy, named E.B., the longtime true loves of Easy's life. Was Easy a one-woman guy? Of course not. But did he believe it was in his best interest and the best interest of his company to sign it over to the woman now known as Tamika Woods Wright? It seems quite possible. Putting aside the question of true love, which we can't really know, Easy may have wanted to marry her at least in part because she was a sensible candidate to run Ruthless. She had a half-decade's experience in the music business, after all, training under the great Clarence Avant. Heller, though, complained that she was simply Avant's secretary, though she later took the title of executive assistant. In fact, I had already given Clarence notice that I was leaving to join Ruthless as general manager when Eric went into the hospital, Woods Wright said. According to numerous Ruthless employees and contractors, Woods Wright quickly parted ways with much of the staff. Bodyguard Joe Fierro said he was abruptly fired and not given severance. Gary Ballin said he was fired by Woods Wright a week or 2 weeks after Easy passed away. Above the Law left Ruthless because their contract was finished. Toker said Brownside also left the label voluntarily, believing it wouldn't be the same without Easy, even though Woods Wright said she'd honor their deal. Bone Thugs and some of the label's top acts were spared. Tracy Jernigan told Vibe she encountered Woods Wright in the hospital, while the latter was working on paperwork. She sat there with Ruthless checks on her lap, making out checks like, he won't be here anymore. You'll see who's running things now.
Yeah, I had paperwork there,
Woods Wright responded in the Vibe story. But for me to say something like that, to be that cruel, anybody who would say that about me is just being malicious. Before it's too late. Not many people outside of Easy's inner circle knew about his condition. But on March 16th, while he lay in the ICU, Easy's camp released a statement on his behalf. At a Hollywood news conference, attorney Ron Sweeney read the message aloud, revealing to the wider world for the first time that Easy had AIDS.
I may not seem like a guy that you'd pick to preach a sermon, but I feel it's now time to testify, because I do have folks that care about me hearing all kinds of stories about what's up. Yeah, I was a brother on the streets of Compton doing a lot of things most people look down on, but it did pay off. Then, we started rapping about real stuff that shook up the LAPD and the FBI. But we got our message across big time, and everyone in America started paying attention to the boys in the hood. Soon, our anger and hopes got everyone riled up. There were great rewards for me personally, like fancy cars, gorgeous women, and good living. Like real nonstop excitement. I'm not religious, but wrong or right, that's me. I'm not saying this because I'm looking for a soft cushion wherever I'm heading. I just feel that I've got thousands and thousands of young fans that have to learn about what's real when it comes to AIDS. Like something good that will reach out to all my homeboys and their kin, because I want to save their asses before it's too late. I'm not looking to blame anyone except myself. I've learned in the last week that this thing is real, and it doesn't discriminate. It affects everyone. My girl Tamika and I have been together for 4 years, and we recently got married. She's good. She's kind and a wonderful mother. We have a little boy who is a year old. Before Tamika, I had other women. I have 7 children by 6 different mothers. Maybe success was too good to me. I love all my kids, and I always took care of them. Now I'm in the biggest fight of my life, and it ain't easy. But I want to say much love to those who have been down with me, and thanks for all your support. Just remember, it's your real time, and your real life.
Woods Wright stood nearby, sobbing. Heller and others close to Easy believe he had little, if anything, to do with the statement's composition. Indeed, at the time of its release, he couldn't breathe without the help of a machine. The statement also miscounts the number of Easy's children. He sired 10 in total, by 8 different mothers, although one with Woods Wright hadn't yet been born. And it seems likely that he didn't know about 2 of them at the time. Woods Wright said the statement was written with his involvement when he was still lucid, around the time of his AIDS diagnosis. Easy's assistant, Charisse Henry, said that before he was put on life support, she told him it was his responsibility to let others know he was sick, if only for the sake of the women he'd slept with.
What would everybody think?
Henry recalls Easy asking.
When have you ever cared what anyone else thinks?
She responded.
They'll think you're a good person, a man of character.
He agreed, and she soon after asked Woods Wright to craft the statement. Henry said. Even if he didn't write it, the spirit of the note feels like Easy. He may have portrayed a nihilistic gangster, but his fans were important to him, particularly the young ones. While the prominent black athletes Magic Johnson and Arthur Ashe had previously revealed HIV diagnoses, Easy was the first urban music star to announce an infection, and he knew his followers would pay attention. The question remained, how did Easy contract HIV? The statement alluding to other women and non-stop excitement seemed to hint that promiscuity might have taken him down. Some people close to him said he liked to use lambskin condoms, which can prevent pregnancy, but aren't recommended in preventing HIV. Others, including Dre and Cube, said he went bareback. Easy seemed to confirm this in a 1992 interview with Howard Stern and his sidekick Robin Quivers on Stern's radio show.
"You heard about AIDS?"
asked Quivers.
"Yeah, but the people I mess with,"
Easy began to respond.
"They're clean," Stern said.
"Yeah."
"How do you know?" asked Quivers.
"Because I would have had it myself if they would have had it."
Easy told his doctor, William Young, that he did not use intravenous drugs or have homosexual sex. Therefore, he must have contracted AIDS through heterosexual contact, Young said. But was it that simple? Isn't it very difficult for men to get HIV from women through heterosexual sex? To help separate fact from fiction, I consulted Gabriel Rotello, the author of Sexual Ecology, a book about the epidemiology of AIDS. He said long-term studies give the odds of a male insertive partner contracting the virus through unprotected sex with a woman to be about 1 in 10,000. That said, a number of factors can greatly increase those odds, he went on, like if the woman has only recently contracted the disease, or if the man is uncircumcised. Easy, however, was circumcised. Since HIV, the infection that attacks the immune system and leads to AIDS, a condition of seriously degraded health, is transmitted through blood, the odds also go up if the man has an opening on his penis, like a scratch, a cut, or an untreated venereal sore. Rotello added that across African American and other disadvantaged communities, needle sharing is often largely responsible for fueling the virus's spread. In fact, he said, heterosexual sex between minority women and minority men who have gotten the virus by sharing needles is the primary thing that keeps the epidemic going among women of color. So, how did Easy contract HIV? The answer may simply be that Easy didn't know, and no one else knows either. Whatever the cause, the news that Eazy-E had AIDS shocked even those who knew him best. It was like a wake-up call, not just for his fans and people who don't know him, but even for me, Dr. Dre told the Los Angeles Times. Distressed fans began calling Cedars-Sinai at an unprecedented rate. "There's been an incredible outpouring of sympathy, and we're not equipped to handle it," said hospital spokeswoman Paula Correa. She said they were receiving some 2,500 calls per day, even more than Lucille Ball when she was admitted there shortly before her 1989 death, more than any celebrity for that matter. Easy's condition quickly deteriorated, and he was moved to the intensive care unit. "We told him we loved him," said Jacob T., one of Easy's bodyguards known as the Twins, "but he couldn't talk. Then we said, if you can hear us, just squeeze our hand." He did. He said, "Come over here tomorrow with the homies," remembered Toker. "I want to leave the hospital in the lowriders." Dr. Dre also got one last chance to visit. With trepidation, he entered the room, shocked to see his friend turned rival unconscious, unable to breathe without a machine. "I felt real bad," he said. "The couple years we spent mad at each other was nothing compared to the time we spent together and had happy times. I felt bad that we didn't get to kick it and have more fun before he passed away." His immune system devastated. Easy was ravaged by a type of pneumonia common in AIDS patients called pneumocystis carinii. A collapsed lung led to heart issues. The situation began to look helpless, and Easy was taken off the ventilator. A Christian minister brought in by his family read him his last rites. "It was one of the saddest days. It was like losing a family member," said DJ Yella. Questions. Some members of Easy's inner circle believe his life could have been saved. A number of my sources for this book insisted he'd been treated by a bogus, unqualified doctor. I did some checking into Easy's attending physician, William Young, who died in 2004. According to his Los Angeles Times obituary, he was a longtime pulmonary and critical care specialist at Cedars-Sinai. a prominent doctor in the black community. His patients included politicians and celebrities, and he founded a nonprofit dedicated to helping low-income people live healthier lifestyles. His record had one notable blemish. In 2002, he was disciplined in writing by the Medical Board of California for repeated negligence in prescribing for a patient while failing to provide proper documentation and renewing the prescription for years without evaluating the patient. Apart from this, what amounted to a slap on the wrist, he seemed well qualified to treat Easy. Still, speculation that something fishy occurred in the lead-up to Easy's death has persisted. His sister, many ruthless artists, and some of his friends do not accept that Easy died of AIDS. They note that none of his children and none of the mothers of his children have come forward saying they have the virus themselves. But this, said author Gabriel Rotello, isn't all that strange. He said people with the virus often don't spread it to their sexual partners or even to their offspring. HIV is the hardest to transmit of all sexually transmitted diseases, he added. Others note suspiciously that while Easy moved quickly from HIV positive to full-blown AIDS and died right away, others have been able to live long lives with the disease, like Magic Johnson, who was diagnosed with HIV in 1991. Johnson's wealth and prominence, of course, afforded him access to treatments that were then rare, drug cocktails that have since turned HIV into a chronic condition, like diabetes, rather than an automatic death sentence. But Easy was rich, too. In the Straight Outta Compton film, he's portrayed as running low on money near the end of his life. But everyone I consulted said this was not true. Easy may have been living with HIV for a long time without realizing it, which is common. Many people with the virus have no symptoms and appear healthy. In 2015, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that more than 150,000 Americans didn't know they had HIV, about 13% of the total. It's possible that Easy's transition from HIV to AIDS only seemed fast. The average latency period for untreated HIV, when the individual is infected but isn't showing symptoms, is about 10 years, which means Easy could have been infected well before he was famous. For those whose HIV progresses into AIDS, they can expect to survive an average of 3 years in the absence of treatment. Easy's sister Patricia Wright doubts he had AIDS because he would always go get checked every 6 weeks, she said. Jerry Heller said Easy had a physical with a Beverly Hills doctor in July 1994 and was given a clean bill of health. Indeed, if Easy got tested regularly for STDs, something should have come up. But HIV screening wasn't then a common component of physicals. Easy's son, Eric Wright Jr., posited a wild theory in an Instagram post in 2015, not long after the Straight Outta Compton film's release. Wright indicated in the post that, if his father died of AIDS, it may have been the result of a purposeful injection. Easy did not get sick until after the studio incident with Suge, he posited. He also pointed to the infamous 2003 Suge Knight interview on Jimmy Kimmel Live, where Suge discussed a new murder tactic in which the assailant gets blood from somebody with AIDS and they inject you with it. Suge called it the Easy-E thing. It's an intriguing theory that Suge might have injected Easy with AIDS some 4 years before he died, but raises many questions. Where would Suge have gotten the tainted blood? Why would he choose this murder method instead of another? And even if he had injected Easy, would Easy have remained silent about it? It all seems extremely unlikely. Ice Cube didn't accuse Suge, but when I interviewed him, he was unwilling to discount conspiracy theories about his friend's death. I can't say they're crazy, because I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure how he contracted that, he said. As a journalist, I thrive on this sort of intrigue. Reporters often build their careers on dispelling accepted narratives, but none of these theories add up. I've talked to numerous doctors and experts about the chain of events leading to Easy's death on March 26, 1995, and none thinks them especially out of the ordinary. Easy was buried in a Whittier cemetery in his Compton hat, Pendleton, and jeans, lowered in a golden coffin. DJ Yella, the only NWA member who'd never fallen out with EZ, and the only one to attend the funeral, served as pallbearer. The memorial service featured a giant photo of EZ in his Lokes. People drove great distances to pay their respects, and thousands of mourners lined up for blocks to watch his coffin pass. Compton Mayor Omar Bradley, who'd once dressed down EZ for his lyrics, declared Eazy-E Day in Compton. One female attendee's shirt read, AIDS is ruthless, so take it easy. In the parking lot, Bone Thugs member Wishbone was apoplectic.
My nigga ain't dead, he sobbed. And if anybody says he is, we fightin'.
Though Easy's gravestone and most obituaries list his birth year as 1963, that is likely not accurate. The funeral program gave his birth year as 1964, as do most official court documents. That would make him only 30 at his death, rather than 31, as was widely reported. Total chaos. Ruthless was valued at around $30 million at the time of Easy's passing, and even before he breathed his last, the machinations to gain control of the company had begun. Mike Klein gave notice to Easy's lawyer, Ron Sweeney, that he was fired on March 24th, 2 days before Easy's death. When Sweeney nonetheless showed up to the Woodland Hills office 3 days later, guards blocked him from entering. Owing to Easy's incapacitation, a superior court judge had ordered the office closed and the locks changed. Mothers of his children stopped receiving child support payments. Label artists ceased receiving paychecks, and employees were told to go home. Having already gotten their first royalty checks, some members of Bone Thugs had returned to Cleveland to buy houses. No one bothered telling them what was happening with Easy. Crazy Bone learned about his death from MTV News. On March 27th, the day after Easy died, a trust company became administrator of his estate. Music industry veteran Ernie Singleton, who'd worked at Ruthless since the previous summer, was appointed to run the label on an interim basis. Singleton's tenure lasted about a year, during which time he released the massive Bone Thugs album and brought Woods Wright into the fold. Everyone under the sun insisted Easy owed them money, and their claims were slowly sorted in probate court. DOC and other artists claimed unpaid earnings, while car dealers, including Mercedes and Jeep, said he owed hundreds of thousands. Realty companies, credit card companies, a video game company, a funeral home, and lawyers all sought sums of varying sizes. Heller said he was owed more than $1 million, while Woods Wright countersued, accusing him of misusing Ruthless funds. An alleged former lover claimed Easy had given her AIDS, and another wanted posthumous paternity testing. The child was found not to be his. Meanwhile, many of the mothers of Easy's children pursued a claim to Easy's estate, contesting the validity of his will and his marriage. In a settlement, trusts were established for each child, valued at $75,000 each, Jernigan said. Easy's widow also settled with Heller. The terms were not disclosed, but their drawn-out negotiations finally wrapped in 1999 and included a mutual non-disparagement clause. Mike Klein, meanwhile, filed suit against Woods Wright and others, claiming they'd unlawfully seized control of the label and taken funds for their own use. He further asserted to own 50% of the label. Klein thought he was going to be the person who stepped up and took Jerry Heller's place and be the confidant, the person getting the percentage, Woods Wright told Vibe. He basically underestimated my relationship with Eric and underestimated me. I wasn't just another woman who laid on her back and fucked Eric. I did have business knowledge. This suit was settled for around $1.5 million, according to an FBI file. Just about everything surrounding Easy's label was filled with chaos. According to an FBI report, footage intended to be used for Ruthless videos was stolen from Easy's Norwalk house. The most shocking allegation, however, concerned missing recordings. Ruthless was hoping to profit off Easy's unreleased music, but some of it was gone. Soon after his death, the FBI investigated the theft of two titanium suitcases containing recordings, 16-inch reels or maybe digital audio cassettes, apparently taken from the trunk of his leased Mercedes. They were likely worth millions. Much of the FBI's declassified report is blacked out, so some details are murky. The man who turned out to be in possession of the music claimed Easy gave it to him before he died. He fled to Ontario, Canada, where he attempted to set up a Ruthless satellite office. Someone purporting to represent Ruthless paid him $12,500 to do this. It's unclear who. But this Canadian office seemed like an attempt to circumvent Ernie Singleton and Tamika Woods Wright's control. Someone even went so far as to re-record the outgoing message on Ruthless's Woodland Hills office's answering machine. The new message said the label's number had been changed and told callers to phone a different Canadian number. The FBI tracked down the man with the tapes, who said he was afraid to return to L.A. In the end, the agency closed the case without charging anyone, and the tapes were never recovered. It's possible unreleased Eazy-E music is still out there. Ultimately, the probate court found Eazy's marriage and his will to be legal, solidifying Woods Wright's leadership at Ruthless. Despite the purported theft, Eazy had yet more unreleased tracks in the vault. And late 1995 saw the release of his modestly received, gold-selling, Straight Off the Streets of Motherfucking Compton. Though Ruthless signed a new distribution deal with Epic in 1997, the label gradually relinquished its heavyweight status. An announced comedy album from Chris Tucker never materialized. The new release schedule slowed to a drip, mainly from its shrinking list of marquee artists like MC Ren, Kid Frost, and Bone Thugs. The latter became increasingly disgruntled and squared off in court with Ruthless a number of times. "Everything has basically changed since Easy passed away. It just ain't the same. Basically, we like slaves now," Crazy Bone told Vibe in 1998, laying the blame on Woods Wright. "She a cool person, but I don't feel she know how to run a record company," said MC Ren. The label moved offices, released a compilation album, and put out another posthumous Eazy-E album in 2002. It nowadays subsists primarily on its back catalog, sales from which were greatly invigorated by the Straight Outta Compton film. Hell and Back. Tamika Woods Wright has been accused of shrouding the events of Eazy's final weeks in secrecy. One cannot, for instance, obtain a copy of their marriage certificate. A courthouse employee told me it had been made private, which is uncommon. "There is no autopsy on this man," Tracy Jernigan said. "The marriage certificate is a secret. The medical records are a secret. Who could go in there and see him was secret." The ensuing decades have also been contentious. When I talked to Eric Wright Jr. in 2014 during the film's pre-production, he said Woods Wright had excluded him and his siblings from the spoils of the movie deal. Wright admits, however, that his stepmother has helped out the family a bit over the years, including paying some bills, paying for a wedding, and giving him an administrative job at Ruthless, though he says it didn't pay well. After her brother's death, Patricia got his Norwalk house and lived there for nearly 20 years before losing it to foreclosure. "It's nobody's fault but my own," she said. Elise Kim, founder of Easy's favorite charity, Athletes and Entertainers for Kids, said that Woods Wright has been generous to her organization, continuing to send out Christmas gifts for their annual gala. It's impossible to know if Woods Wright has done with his estate what Easy would have wanted her to. Wright wishes the company had been passed to Heller. "As a Jew, as a white man, he would have handled business," he said. One thing is clear. Woods Wright's life since his death has been no fairy tale. "That woman has been to hell and back," said S. Lay Savage, a filmmaker who said she broke down in front of him during a 2006 interview.
I'm inclined to give Woods Wright the benefit of the doubt. Only 26 when Easy died. It's unimaginable how much stress she's experienced, starting from the moment Easy told her he had HIV. Ultimately, she and her two children with Easy tested negative. She became responsible not just for his care, but for the label and handling the media and dealing with everyone who wanted a piece of him. Such duties would try anyone.
I was not the cause of his death, she told Vibe in 1998. I did not kill him. I was the one by his side, and I am the one trying to keep his dream alive. As far as anybody else who might be saying stuff, I could give a damn.
Through little more than instincts and hard work, Easy, the one-time drug dealer, launched the most enduring movement hip-hop has ever seen. The popularity of gangster rap was further solidified by the success of Bone Thugs and Harmony's 4 million selling magnum opus, E, 1999 Eternal, released just 4 months after Easy's death. Their enduring Grammy-winning ballad, The Crossroads, is dedicated to him, and the album has Easy's stamp all over it. As with Bone Thugs, he gave voice to people who were born with little, but who weren't going to be pushed around. Anyone defining themselves on their own terms, who couldn't care less about convention and expectation, harbor a little bit of Easy's renegade spirit. Chapter 21. Political Prophet. Slight of stature, with a shaved head, crooked teeth, and a diamond on his nose, Tupac's most striking physical features were surely his beautiful expressive brown eyes. Though he wasn't much for sports, he had an athlete's body and a seductive liquid way of moving. He forever churned with ideas and spoke with great intensity on whatever subject, the veins in his head popping when he really got on a roll. During his short life, he wanted to experience everyone, feel the deepest emotions, and speak the greatest truths. He detested sobriety and smoked weed like cigarettes, although he smoked cigarettes too. He impatiently recorded his songs immediately after writing them. As a rapper, he wasn't the master of cadence and wordplay like his rival Biggie Smalls, though he was no slouch. What he did was reach more people than any other MC. In America, he's a staple of classic rap radio, and in South America, you can find his fans in the most desperate shanty towns. Democratic Republic of the Congo soldiers and Ivory Coast rebels have worn gear adorned with Tupac images, as did a Sierra Leone rebel army who conquered villages to the tune of California Love. Houston tattooist Dennis Coelho gave Tupac the giant cross on his back, with the words, Exodus 18:31, referencing the year of Nat Turner's slave rebellion. Coelho said the shop has since done thousands and thousands of Tupac-inspired tattoos. We do the Tupac cross almost daily, he said. Eminem has sold more albums than any other rapper, narrowly edging out Tupac. It's not quite apples to apples, considering Tupac's heyday was before digital downloading cut into record sales. Then again, Eminem has been making music for decades longer than Tupac. They share a movie star aura and R-rated pinup appeal, and have both shaped popular culture. But only Tupac transcended music to become something of a political prophet. Admirers pore over his lyrics, letters, and interviews like those of famous revolutionaries. In terms of influence, I'd say his closest musical equivalent is Bob Dylan. Like Dylan, he may not be the best, technically, at his craft, but there's something true about him. Something that hits you right there. Tupac brought to life the experience of being desperate, black, and poor. He didn't judge criminals, gangbangers, or anyone doing what they needed to do. He spoke out against the U.S. Congress's 1994 crime bill, signed by Bill Clinton, now seen by many as a fear-driven mistake that drove us to historically high incarceration rates. When asked by Vibe's Kevin Powell why so many young African Americans identified with him, Tupac said, "'Cause we all soldiers, unfortunately.'
Everybody's at war with different things. With ourselves. Some are at war with the establishment. Some of us are at war with our own communities.
He was as passionate and vulnerable as he was provincial and vindictive. Tupac rapped about fighting back, extending the ethos of Ice-T and N.W.A., but he was even brasher. He battled with cops who did him dirty, drawing more bad press than nearly anyone this side of O.J. Simpson. He came out on top through charisma and brutal honesty.
"I love it when they fear me," he said,
wrote Vibes Danielle Smith.
But more truly, he loved not fearing them.
He was free when he didn't give a fuck about anything, including continuing his own life, when he felt like the world, for a change, was his. Though he used Ho in his songs and was convicted of sexually abusing a 19-year-old woman, he penned three of the most elegant songs ever dedicated to black women: Brenda's Got a Baby, Keep Your Head Up, and Dear Mama. Long before the Black Lives Matter movement, Tupac pondered aloud why African-American murders were often seen as no big deal. He mused about building an underground bunker where he and his armed comrades could go if things went south. And go south they did. Tupac's distrust of police dated back to the very beginning of his life, when his pregnant mother was falsely imprisoned. He sometimes carried a video camera so he could document interactions with cops. Though his debut, Tupacalypse Now, featured stories about characters taking him out, Tupac said that he'd personally never had a run-in with police. That changed in October 1991, shortly after the album's release, when he was stopped by Oakland officers for jaywalking and asked for ID.
"The police sweated me about my name," he said,
and an argument ensued.
"Next thing I know, I was in a chokehold passing out with cuffs on, headed for jail for resisting arrest."
It was life imitating his song, Trapped, in which his character is brutally manhandled by cops. Tupac filed suit against the department and received a $42,000 settlement. Even more astonishingly, 2 years later he somehow got away with shooting a pair of off-duty cops. In late 1993, two suburban Atlanta officers, brothers named Mark and Scott Whitwell, were arguing with a motorist when Tupac, in town to perform a local show, came upon the scene. He didn't know the car's African-American driver, and didn't realize the Whitwells were police, as they were dressed in civilian attire. Believing the brothers were harassing the driver, Tupac jumped into the fray. Bullets began flying, and Tupac hit both cops, at least one in the behind. The motorist, named Kendall Hunter, later credited Tupac with saving his life, but Tupac was nonetheless jailed and charged with aggravated assault. To many reporters, this was a clear case of him acting out a revenge fantasy from one of his songs. News accounts were peppered with Tupacalypse Now lyrics like,
"Drop them or let them drop you. I chose dropping the cop."
But Mark Whitwell was also charged with firing at Tupac's car and giving false statements to police. And in the end, charges against both parties were dropped when it was revealed that the Whitwells had been drinking. Further, a prosecution witness testified that a gun from one of the officers had been illegally seized from an evidence locker. It was one thing to say, "fuck the police," but something else to battle them so brazenly, in the South no less. The incident sealed him as not only a rapper, but a person who was true to the game, said his stepfather Mutulu Shakur. Poetic Justice. Tupac's breakout film role in 1992's Juice was serendipity. He had tagged along with Digital Underground's Money B to the audition, and, without any prior preparation, he competed for the part against Tretch from Naughty by Nature. Drawing upon his real-life hurt and anger, Tupac's audition made him the obvious choice for the role of Bishop. The film, directed by Ernest R. Dickerson, came on the heels of John Singleton's Boys in the Hood, and has some similar themes, though it's set in Harlem. A group of high school friends attempt a robbery, urged on by Bishop, but the situation unravels as he becomes increasingly unhinged. Tupac comes alive in the film's second half with his manic intensity. Featuring a score by Hank Shocklee and the Bomb Squad, the film was a success, and Tupac was singled out for praise. Having studied at Baltimore School for the Arts, Tupac was familiar with method acting. As he explained, "The camera just happened to catch real emotions." Singleton picked Tupac for his boy's follow-up, 1993's Poetic Justice. Strong admirers of each other's work, the pair envisioned a collaborative partnership like Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro. Still, Poetic Justice was a difficult shoot, and Tupac clashed with his co-star Janet Jackson. He said he was asked by members of the crew, presumably at her request, to take an AIDS test before a romantic scene, and he refused. Poet Maya Angelou, meanwhile, deplored his on-set cursing and talked him down after he almost got into a fight.
"Do you know that we stood on slave ship decks and stood on auction blocks and were hosed down like dogs for you so you could live?" she asked him.
He began crying, and she put her arm around him, wiping his tears with her hands. The film was partly shot in Oakland, often in the depths of night. Tupac was taunted by community members who'd known him as a semi-transient only years before. They hung out on the periphery of the set, trying to get his attention or provoke a fight.
"Don't pretend that you don't know me, nigga," they yelled. "Nigga's a movie star and can't speak to nobody."
Tupac somehow took all of this graciously.
"They're sitting there, knowing they used to give me money to go to the store, and now I've got their whole family taking pictures with me," he said. "That's an animosity that nothing I can do can kill, because that's poverty shit, and I can understand."
Tupac had diverse taste in music beyond hip-hop, running from Kate Bush to the Les Miserables soundtrack, which he'd listen to at night to calm his nerves. During the day, he'd get high in his trailer and storm around set. Once he was told he'd have a day off, only to have producers inform him that he'd instead have to shoot publicity photos.
"I can't take this shit. Y'all treat a nigga like a slave," he groused,
and then proceeded to punch out a window in his trailer. Filming also took place in L.A., and Tupac moved there for the first time, living in a house on a tranquil street in the San Fernando Valley with his mother, with whom he had reconciled. He journeyed all over L.A. and its southern perimeter to Watts and Compton, learning the neighborhoods and the gangs, determining whom he could and couldn't trust. He warned Singleton when specific gangbangers planned to come to the set, but it wasn't just the guys on the corners. Tupac got to know everyone under the Southern California sun. The alcoholics, pimps, robbers, burglars, nerds, homosexuals, and prophets, he said. Anyone who could teach him how to survive in the big city. Also in 1993, he released his second album, Strictly for My Niggas, another hit. Though its most popular track, I Get Around, is a boilerplate warning to ladies who tie him down, the work is otherwise populated with heartbreaking stories about the struggles of black folks. The title, according to his stepbrother Mo Preem, references the fact that, "No matter what we do, we still gonna be niggas to certain people." "I'm sick of being tired," Tupac raps on The Streets Are Death Row, a song unrelated to the label. "Sick of the sirens, body bags, and the gun firing. Tell Bush push the button 'cause I'm fed. Tired of hearing these voices in my head." Strictly shows a maturity in his songwriting. Papa's Song is not a standard, "fuck you, dad," lament. Rather, after a son admonishes his father for being gone during his childhood, Papa gives his side of the story. Having heard the five stair steps, ooh, child, things are gonna get easier, in Boys in the Hood, Tupac employed a sample of it on Keep Your Head Up. "Some say the blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice. I say the darker the flesh, then the deeper the roots," begins the song, which would later inspire rapper Kendrick Lamar. It's dedicated in part to Latasha Harlins, the 15-year-old killed in 1991, by a South Central store owner who believed she was shoplifting. Like Tupacalypse Now, Strictly for My Niggas, documents the tribulations of and provides a balm for those making their way through a racist society. These aren't really gangsta rap albums, since gangsta implies characters enriching themselves through criminal enterprise and violence. That wasn't Tupac, at least not yet. Tupac's activism was largely lost on white critics. It probably didn't help he was constantly going to jail. Slated to perform a homecoming show at a 1992 Marin City festival, he was confronted by a group of people angry over negative interview comments he'd made in the press about his former town. "It was a combination of jealousy and anger," said Mo Preem, who was with him that day. "Pac was becoming successful. There was a lot of haters." A tussle broke out. Shots were fired, and a 6-year-old boy riding a bicycle nearby was accidentally killed. Though Tupac didn't fire the gun, a .380 Colt automatic, it was registered to him. A sheriff sergeant accused Mo Preem of pulling the trigger. "I'm not talking about who did what. I'm not a snitch," Mo Preem told me when I interviewed him in 2016. "It was just unfortunate and sad, and we didn't start it." Tupac and Mo Preem were arrested and then released, owing to a lack of evidence. But the boys' parents filed a civil suit, which was settled for a 6-figure sum, paid by Tupac's record label. Tupac was dogged by legal trouble for much of his adult life. In 1993, he allegedly assaulted a limo driver outside of an In Living Color taping after the man complained the rapper was smoking weed. The charges were dropped. Shortly thereafter, at a show in Lansing, Michigan, Tupac brandished a baseball bat against another rapper and did a short jail stint. He said he and his road manager were provoked. "I beat up the director of Minister Society," he bragged on Yo MTV Raps that same year, referencing the film directed by Alan and Albert Hughes, in which he'd been slated to appear. "They fired me, but did it in a roundabout punk snitch way. So I caught them on the streets and beat their behind." Alan Hughes tells the story differently. Before he was canned, Tupac was disruptive on set, in front of a cast that included Jada Pinkett, Hughes said. For the sake of the movie, Tupac needed to go, he added, saying the firing was straightforward. But Tupac lost his $300,000 payday, and not long afterward, at a video shoot, confronted Hughes with a posse of Crips in tow. Tupac threw a sucker punch. Hughes threw him on top of a truck, and then the Crips beat Hughes badly. After bragging about the incident on Yo MTV Raps, Tupac got 15 days in jail. The Hughes brothers had worked with Tupac before, initially finding him funny and charming, but something changed around the time of Juice's release in early 1992, Allen said, claiming that after Tupac saw a screening of the film, he was never the same. He said Tupac subsequently began rolling heavy with gang members, switching sets a lot, whether with the Rolling 60s or the Bloods or some gang in Houston, whichever fit where he was at the time. Indeed, Tupac was photographed in both red and blue bandanas, though he doesn't appear to have joined any gang in particular. He also got increasingly tatted up. Though common today, heavily inked rappers were then rare. Tupac's work included his now iconic Thug Life tattoo across his abs, which stood for "The hate you give little infants fucks everyone." Thug Life was Tupac's mantra. It was a code that informed the Watts Peace Treaty he helped craft, and it was the name of one of his rap groups. "It was really supposed to be about saving thugs' lives," said Mo Preem, a Thug Life member. "A lot of people got the message, but a whole lot didn't." "I'm thugging against society. I'm thugging against the system that made me," Tupac said. Even Tupac's mother, Afeni, didn't initially understand it, finding the word thug hard to reconcile with the Black Panther ideals on which her son was raised. On the 1992 day when she found out he was going to get his Thug Life tattoo, she begged his friend, Sharice Henry, to drive over to the Sunset Strip tattoo parlor to stop it. Henry arrived too late. A terror since the public school era. Valletta Wallace equated bulk with health, and she fed her son Christopher well. An immigrant, Valletta arrived in the U.S. from Jamaica at age 17 in the late 60s. She became involved with a much older Jamaican man named Selwyn Latour. After Christopher was born, Latour fell out of the picture. As it turned out, he had a whole other family in London. Raised in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood of Brooklyn, Christopher was an intelligent student who was good at drawing and worked for a time as a grocery bag boy. He began drug dealing when he was about 12, he said, buying polo shirts and fancy shoes with his earnings and stashing them on the roof to retrieve them in the morning before he went to school, so his mother wouldn't suspect. Eventually, Valletta, who was working two jobs and obtained a master's degree in education, kicked him out. He traveled to North Carolina to sell rocks and was arrested on a drug charge when he was 17, he said, spending about 9 months behind bars. With a girlfriend named Jan Jackson, he had a daughter named Tiana in 1993. Along the way, he managed to impress some well-connected people with his blossoming rap skills. Big Daddy Kane's DJ, Mr. C, heard his tape and encouraged him to send it to The Source magazine, who selected him for their influential, unsigned hype column. Wallace, whose weight would swell to well over 300 pounds, rapped under the name Biggie Smalls. But after a dispute with those involved with the film from which the handle came, the Sidney Poitier-Bill Cosby 1975 movie, Let's Do It Again, he went officially by Notorious B.I.G. A Source editor named Matteo Matty C. Capaluongo played Biggie's tape for Sean Puffy Combs, who worked as an A&R for a hip-hop and R&B label called Uptown Records. Puffy's rise was like something out of a movie. His father, before being gunned down, was an associate of famed Harlem drug kingpin Frank Lucas. Like Tupac, Puffy started as a backing dancer for acts including Heavy D and the Boys. But his career was almost derailed before it began. In 1991, 9 people were killed at an event he organized called the Heavy D and Puff Daddy Celebrity Charity Basketball Game. Held at City College, it was wildly oversold. Fans tore doors off hinges, and gate crashers were crushed up against ticket holders inside a stairwell. A subsequent investigation questioned whether the AIDS education outreach program flyers claimed the game would benefit actually existed. Puffy rebounded from the tragedy, as well as his 1993 firing from Uptown Records. He was headstrong and growing increasingly interested in gangster rap, which was outside Uptown's scope. He took Biggie to his own imprint, called Bad Boy, which was funded with the help of a partnership with Arista Records, founded by Clive Davis. Bad Boy was largely inspired by the styles and tropes of Death Row and The Chronic. New York hip-hop wasn't used to following other cities' trends, but it was hard to deny the appeal of funky, hard-edged rhymes. Notorious B.I.G.'s first appearance was on a remix of Uptown artist Mary J. Blige's 1992 hit, Real Love, followed by his own Party and Bullshit a year later, from the Who's the Man soundtrack. The latter track is a small miracle of pacing, style, and assonance, with Biggie rapping expeditiously about being a terror since the public era, when he was wielding bathroom passes, cutting classes, squeezing asses. He hadn't quite found his tempo, but his potential seemed unlimited. Biggie himself had an undeniable West Coast influence, listening to Ice Cube's America's Most Wanted before recording his own debut, Ready to Die. One of Biggie's favorite rappers was Compton's King T. He adopted a similar cadence and a love for weed rhymes. "Biggie came out here and studied under King T," said Chris the Glove Taylor. "When he came out here, he sounded one way. And when he went back, he sounded like King T." Having absorbed the West Coast influence, Biggie emerged with his own dense melodic style, and 1994's well-reviewed game-changing Ready to Die sold 6 million copies. From a technique perspective, he was untouchable. His rhymes, platonic ideals. With extraordinary timing and breath control, each line inspired the next. Like a high-speed train,